Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the 8-Bit Adventures Podcast. I am your host, Sean Hayes, here to bring you the latest and greatest geeky news of the week. We got a couple of interesting news items this week. Our deep dive is going to be some first impressions on Pokemon Legends Arceus. I've been playing that on stream. So we've got an interesting mix of we've got some tabletop, namely some D&D news, as well as a whole bunch of gaming news. Some stuff that's actually gaming news and not just like business decisions, but we've got some of those as well. Hope everyone's doing well. That you're all, if you are local to where this podcast is recorded, hope you are staying warm and toasty, and ready for more snow as we've got another storm coming. It seems it is never ending, right? This time of year. Why don't we get right into it? So let's get into, the quick fire news for this week. All right, so first up, seems like not to be outdone by Microsoft, Sony Interactive announced a $3.6 billion deal to buy Bungie, formerly known as the developers who worked on Halo, but are now pretty much known for Destiny. This is almost entirely in reaction to Microsoft's move to buy Activision Blizzard. But you'll notice this, you know, it only encompasses like one studio, but big difference in price where, you know, Microsoft spent, you know, $68 billion in change for Activision Blizzard King. And this is like $3.5 billion for Bungie. So, you know, a little difference there. But this is pretty much so that Sony can get Destiny. I did see a meme of folks pointing out to Sony, like, you know, it's free on Steam, right? But you know, I think ultimately this is so that Sony can leverage Bungie's development expertise, I guess, and Destiny, and be able to try and push some exclusivity for whatever they may do next, I think is where we're going with that. We'll see what further developments may shake out of there. Again, I don't think there's going to be any regulatory issues with this going through. Because as I said, with the Activision Blizzard King purchase, like, that's a much bigger purchase and that would attract more attention. But the fact that Disney was able to buy, you know, Marvel, Star Wars, and Fox without issue, like the entertainment branch of Fox without issue, I don't see this being a problem, regulatory wise. So, we'll keep you posted if there's any further developments on this. Next up, Monsters of the Multiverse. So we have on the graphic here, the official release date is May 17, 2022. This book, however, is available now as part of the box set, along with Tasha's Cauldron of Everything and Xanathar's Guide to Everything. It's a little bit of a scumball move from Wizards of the Coast of releasing a book 3 months early, 3.5 months early, as part of a gift set with two books that pretty much everybody that plays D&D already has. Or it forces you to wait until May. That's my own personal feelings on the matter. This book is largely a lot of reprinting and reorganizing of existing content. So, what it does is it brings a lot of the sort of race options in D&D that were outside of the player's handbook, collects them all into one book, which, you know, the main advantage for that would have been Adventurers League with their plus, you know, player's handbook plus one requirement, but they have done away with that. It's mostly to consolidate for newer players and sort of bring them into what is now considered the design standard, which was optional rules in Tasha's. So there's some consternation about that. I think it's baloney personally. You know, I think it's from people who come from wanting a internally what's the word? Internally consistent system, as opposed to one that makes more sense narratively, and gets away from some sort of ticky-tacky issues that D&D has, with like bioessentialism. But ultimately, some of the big overarching changes that you can see are stuff involving short rests, like recharging on a short rest, has gone away in favor of abilities being used a number of times per day equal to your proficiency bonus, and a lot of stuff circulating around the proficiency bonus. Everything moving to like +2/+1 for ability scores, like no standard alignments, no standard languages, and like getting rid of a lot of cultural stuff, whether it's just removed entirely or it's been reformatted and reworked into such a way that it has a unique and interesting perspective that sets something apart, as opposed to, oh, they just have a culture that they use bows or they use axes, you know, as previously with elves and dwarves. So there's that. Ultimately, a lot of stuff got a bit of a glow up. And anything involving spells is now, they use spells from the player's handbook. So this was true of Ganassi being reprinted. You know, I think still a lot of people, I noted, are homebrewing sort of the base spells that were in the original free piece of content that they arrived in, where it included a bunch of like elemental manipulation cantrips, because it seems weird to not have them be part of the Ganassi's base kit. There was one other thing that's like a big overarching change that pretty much applied to everybody, and I can't remember it. Everything, like all other forms of speeds, are based on walking speed, which means that any improvement to your walking speed now scales that form of movement as well. This has just made monks better, since now anytime your walking speed increases, other forms of movement increase as well. So there were some modifications to speed to counterbalance that. Also, everything that had a movement speed of 25 feet got improved to 30 feet. So this is likely when Wizards has been doing some polls and stuff, presumably for an update to the core books. We may likely see, dwarves, gnomes, and halflings get a speed bump as well. Just to sort of keep everybody on the same page, I guess. A lot of the lore, the quote unquote standard lore across the multiverse has been, changed so that it's not necessarily setting specific, in doing so kind of removes problematic elements from them and rethinks them in such a way that it's in a more positive light. Like Kenku are one particular case for that, where they are no longer cursed as a species, and instead, and that they don't have like mechanical limitations, which sometimes folks ignore because they can become disruptive and silly, but and instead paints them in a much more positive light, and gives them lore like that. Mechanically, they didn't really do a whole lot as far as mechanical changes, but by changing the flavor a bit, allows people to rethink how they think about them, so that instead of like, you know, being forced to live as like thieves and burglars, it's now also like archivists and historians and scribes and things like that, because even just something as simple as like perfect recollection or like perfect diction or something, of like being able to effortlessly recreate, you know, a visual or written piece of work, is different than saying like, oh, you're an expert forgerer. So, you know, it takes it from like essentially keeping all the same skill sets, but removing sort of the criminal element from them, and just painting them in a much more neutral or positive light. Subraces. Now it's just everything's just distinct, instead of just being like you have elf and then you have wood elf, high elf, and all that stuff. So that's just an organizational sort of thing for the book in terms of layout. And it'll specifically call out, like, you know, if something doesn't have like elf, dwarf, or whatever in its name, it'll still say like, this counts as a dwarf, this counts as an elf. So there's that. Goblinoids get a bit of a glow up and a bunch of fey traits as well, which I think is interesting, and it carries over from fourth edition doing a bunch of stuff with the fey wild and goblins. So I'm excited about that. I have not picked up this book. This is all from people posting stuff about it. I'm not going to pick it up until May when it's available. Because I have opinions on the decision to release it as part of a gift set 3 months prior to releasing it as a standard release. Like, there is no reason, unless there are supply chain issues and they couldn't get the regular one, there's no reason to have delayed the single copy release. Because now people are either going to, like, realistically speaking, like, I don't condone it, but realistically, there's people who are going to do some seafaring and essentially have all the information and say, like, well, I don't need the book now. Or people will have been turned off by it and just say, like, well, I'm not going to use it. And, you know, I'm not happy with this business decision. So I think Wizards shot themselves in the foot with this business practice. So yeah, that may be a hot take. I don't know. I don't care. It's been a rough day, and I have no problems taking it out on Wizards of the Coast. All right. Next up, speaking of business decisions, the New York Times has purchased Wordle, the recent sort of daily word game that has taken the internet by storm, for a sum, quote, in the low seven figures, end quote. So this sounds like it was developed by just like a person, presumably based on the name. I don't have the name written down, but it seemed like it was a gentleman, but like a single developer. And so this person just like made, you know, several million dollars. For the time being, the New York Times has said that it's going to keep it free, but they want to add it to their offerings of word games and puzzles. Cynical belief is it was competing with the New York Times crossword puzzle, which is behind a paywall. And so people were doing this, and this was super popular, whereas the New York Times, like, you know, their crossword puzzle is known for being the standard, but you have to pay to access it, and it's fairly expensive for just a crossword puzzle. So we'll see. We'll see how long Wordle lasts before it gets put behind a paywall. And once it does, I think you're going to see the popularity drop right off. Or that people are just going to move on to a clone of Wordle that's like slightly different and therefore legally distinct. So ultimately, people with far too much money doing far too silly things. So, all right, next up. You know what? I should have put this. Oh, no, we didn't talk about Blizzard yet. So, so once again, sort of like last week, no dire legal news for Activision Blizzard. Shocking, I know. Another week without an actual game news. But this one is Blizzard is testing cross-faction dungeons, raids, and rated PvP. So what this means is that you will be able to, when you set up groups to do raids and stuff like that, you will be able to queue up with members of the opposing faction. And there are specifications for like disallowing cross-faction. While you're in the dungeon, like everybody's treated as friendly and everything, but like once you're back outside, is once again, unfriendly at best or hostile at worst. Depending on, you know, whether you play on a PvE, PvP server, or, you have war mode on or whatever. This is not being extended to guilds. So there's a lot of folks who are, you know, there's a lot of folks excited about this because ultimately the lore of World of Warcraft has moved away from the factions being hostile toward each other, time and time again, and like having this truce or actively working together or having factions that are like having factions in game that are literally cross faction, like the Earthen Ring or, the Cenarian Circle, or other factions like that, where it's like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, it makes more sense to have something like the Cenarian Circle be a faction that you can pick instead of Horde or Alliance than it does to have Horde and Alliance. A lot of folks think this may be pressure from Final Fantasy 14, where, I mean, technically you pick a faction, but it doesn't really matter. Or the same thing with ESO, where newer MMOs are moving away from having, like, it's, you know, there's no point in having opposing factions, if you're just going to be a bunch of mercenaries and go out and do mercenary work. And especially if you have factions in game that are cross faction anyway. Cynical take is without there being cross faction capability for guilds, this isn't going to do a whole lot to fix server balance for like end game raiding, because if you need to be in a raiding guild to do like progression raiding, then you're still going to have to pick a faction that matches the rest of the guild. So, but this could be a step in the right direction. And maybe we might get, you know, It would certainly solve the problem of stuff happening currently. And, you know, it's not like you can't still have stuff happen in game where there is conflict, you know. The irony is, like, you know, there's been a big hullabaloo about, you know, the fact that it's called Warcraft, not Peacecraft or whatever. Despite the fact that, like, even if you remove the Horde versus Alliance factions, like the whole game is still based around, you know, there are still conflicts happening. It's just that it might not be the two main factions opposing each other. They're just either collectively or individually opposing some other force, whether it's the Burning Legion, whether it's the Lich King and his forces, whether it's, you know, the old gods, whether it's, I don't know. There's all sorts of other stuff. What, you know, whether it's ogre tribes in you know, Negrand in Outland, you know, whether it's dragons, you know, the black dragon flight, there's plenty of opportunities for there to be war in your Warcraft without having it need to be faction versus faction, or at least without it needing to be Horde versus Alliance, you know, and even PvP. Because you can already do, like, as a mercenary mode or whatever, like, join up with the other faction. So, like, PvP could just end up being, quote-unquote, you know, just mercenary groups, right? Where it's one group, you know, essentially you get hired out to be part of a mercenary group for, I don't know, like everything around Warcraft PvP is like rated PvP is about like battlegrounds and arena and stuff. Which lore wise, it could just be that there's two opposing forces, not necessarily opposing factions, but just opposing forces that are hiring out mercenaries to help them recapture stuff. And I think this would open it up to be more interesting lore-wise, because then you can start having, like, if there's, you know, intra-faction conflict as opposed to inter-faction conflict, so that, you know, maybe it's two separate groups of dwarves that want mining rights to something, or it's, you know, Tauren and Night Elves are saying, like, don't cut down these trees, and it's, like, orcs and humans being like, no, let's cut down the trees, or something. You know, very, very simple ideas for PvP, but I think it's a step in the right direction. I think if these are ideas that the game is going to put forth and they're willing to take a good hard look at their internal systems and say, what doesn't work anymore? What are other MMOs doing that like makes them more appealing than our game? And not just for, you know, the social reasons behind the company itself, but like the actual, for people who don't necessarily care about what's going on with the company, but like stop playing because of the game itself. You know, if they went on to Final Fantasy 14 or to ESO or to other MMOs, like what are they doing that's drawing in people that we could adapt and, you know, do our own version of? Again, cautiously optimistic. I'm still not going back until I get proof, like a good hard evidence of one, the company's better. And then two, like the game's actually better because the game's not in a good state right now. So likely won't happen until after Microsoft takes over. But we'll see. We'll see. I do hold out hope because, you know, it would be nice to go back to WoW when it's in a good state. Because personally, I have tried Final Fantasy 14. I like some of the systems, but like the art style is really off-putting to me and I can't get past it. And I feel bad. Like, it's weird to say, like, I feel bad because the art style is off-putting. It is. Like, I don't know what it is about it. It's like it's very busy. And for me, it's very hard for stuff to stand out. So it's like very difficult for me to navigate around things in there. And it like everything just sort of blends in together. It's not my jam. So, all right. Prepare for this last bit of news, because this came as a shock to everybody today. So the Pokemon Company has announced there is a Diamond Pearl sound library available. Now, for independent sort of amateur content creators, and for just general folks who are looking to use these sounds, there is essentially a free licensing agreement that specifies that like what you can use this stuff for, right? This is huge. Like, it doesn't actually help people that are, you know, like, it doesn't help me because, you know, I do collect, you know, I do get money for Twitch subscriptions. I do run ads. Technically, there's ads on the YouTube videos for VODs and stuff. Maybe, you know, I honestly don't even know if there are or not. And I have the Patreon. So like, technically my stuff would be considered a commercial property because of that. So I can't benefit from this. Now for folks who are just like, yeah, I just want to do like a school project and use Pokemon music, or, you know, if you want to play Pokemon music at your wedding, and it's not a DJ that's collecting money from it. So for example, when I got married, like we didn't hire a DJ, we just played music. Don't tell the internet, but, essentially we had a playlist, right? And we played it. We didn't end up using half of it because of stuff that happened. But this allows you to legally be able to, as long as it's not a commercial project and as long as you follow the guidelines of the terms of use, you have access to be able to use these songs in personal video and music creation. So it also allows you to do covers as long as you're doing them for fun and you are not collecting any ad revenue or subscription revenue or anything like that from it. Again, I would love it to go a step further and have like an affordable license be available for smaller independent content creators. This is a huge first step, especially in light of the news that Nintendo just like apparently took down or sent like 3,500 like content ID requests to some, I don't know, some YouTuber. I don't know the name. But like this is big. And it is apparently sound effects and music from Diamond and Pearl. So whether we start seeing this happen with other generations, I don't know. This may be a test case for them. I think ultimately, I'm for one shocked because I'm normally quite cynical of what Game Freak and Pokemon Company do. But like, I'm kind of shocked they didn't start with Red and Blue. For once, I think it's because they did the Diamond and Pearl remake recently. But I would imagine if this goes over well, we'll see a Red and Blue sound library as well, since that's iconic. Like Lavender Town is probably one of the most remixed pieces of music from Pokemon. So I would expect to see other editions or other generations coming as well. But it would be really nice to have them see, like, if this is successful, to then start opening up, like, again, like, you could even have the same license terms and, you know, do something like Monster Cat, where it's a low monthly payment that you pay. And you get access to those that you can then use for YouTube and Twitch and things like that. And it's just literally, like, it's not remixes or covers or anything. It's just straight up, sound effects and music from the game. This is great. if you're like a student, you know, wanting to do it for a school project, and then you can actually say, like, yes, I did this. And then, also, like, not have to get into the weird thing of, like, you know, it's for education, like, but do I not have the rights to do it? Now this solves it. Again, Diamond and Pearl, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt. If you want to make here's the thing. If you want to do some sort of remix that is just a sample of the Pokemon cries of Turtwig, Grodel, and Torterra, you can now do that as long as you're just doing it for fun. you can post to social media, you can post it to anything that distributes stuff. It's you just can't collect ad revenue. And here's the thing. Like, they even specify, like, they have questions to specify, like, well, what if I collect ad revenue but donate it? Like, nope, you can't do that. I mean, this is shocking. It shocked me. I was like, wow. Something that falls under the portfolio of Nintendo actually made a sensible 21st century business decision. For anybody that's ever thought of me as a giant Nintendo fanboy, like, no, Nintendo, they make all sorts of weird businesses, especially around licensing to content creators. Like, they're bad. So this is awesome. It's not quite there, not fully quite there yet, but it is a huge first step. So I think ultimately, if it proves to be really successful, I could see them saying like, oh, well, like I don't understand how somebody didn't walk in and be like, hey, you know, if you charge like $5 to $10 a month and offer a license, like for this stuff, for commercial purposes, you know, and even have it be you could even have it be based on like number of projects or like number of downloads or something. Essentially like generated by traffic, right? Where if you meet a certain threshold of traffic, like now you have to upgrade your license. And like I'm sure that would be easy to track, you know, because you already use Content ID, so just use Content ID to then, you know, throw a ping if somebody uses it, and then just go look at the metrics for that video, and then just say, oh, hey, you know, your video has now reached this certain threshold. You just, you know, in order to keep this license, you have to bump up your license tier, we'll say. So yeah, I'm shocked that nobody's told them that they can make a bunch of money just by doing that. So hopefully somebody tells the Pokemon company about that. Not that they need any more money, but you know, that's literally why they do things. So yeah, and speaking of which, that is going to wrap it up for our news segments. So it's time for the deep dive, which is my first impressions on Pokemon Legends Arceus. Okay, so for this discussion, I'm going to try and stay away from story spoilers, but I may talk about mechanics, or but I'm going to talk about mechanics that pop up within the first 4 or 5 hours of gameplay, depending on how quickly you progress through the story. So bear that in mind. If that's something that you consider spoilers and you don't want to find out about, by all means. But if you're like, well, it's mechanics and it's not really story, so okay, you know, that's fine. I just want people to be informed. I'm not gonna put spoilers up on the thumbnail for this on YouTube or on the Twitch VOD. Because again, I'm not gonna be spoiling story. So there's that disclaimer. So first things first, we kind of have to talk about the elephant in the room with Pokemon Legends Arceus. It is not a pretty game. It does not look good. The frame rate is okay. There are definitely situations where they use like a dynamic frame rate for objects, where distant objects are a much lower frame rate, which, you know, other games do. You know, Monster Hunter did it. It seems like it was less notable in Monster Hunter Rise. I haven't clipped it. Or I wasn't playing on stream. I can't remember, but in a cutscene, there is a Pokemon in the background, and it's not that far away. It's like across a room, and the room's not that big. And the Pokemon is animating at about 10 frames a second, whereas everybody in the foreground is animating at 30 frames a second, and it is very, very noticeable and very distracting. There is no anti-aliasing in the game, so everything is jagged. It's like you could smooth that, and that would do a whole lot in your game. It's the colors are just very flat. They're very muddy. And it was like, I don't know if they're going for sort of an earth tone watercolor. It does not work. It's like a very common criticism of the game is like it's just trying to copy Breath of the Wild. That would be true if they did it well. Like, it is okay to copy one of the most popular games of this generation if you're going to pull it off. And this game does not pull it off. And I mentioned that on stream in my criticism of like Genshin was able to do this and it runs on phones. This game has problems, just visually. Now that said, everything in the foreground, like I haven't had any hiccups in overall frame rate. It's just they do that weird dynamic thing. And I don't know if it's Game Freak just really got scared of the whole open world thing and didn't know how to make it work. I mean, Game Freak's not exactly known for great optimization throughout history. So this may have just been a little too much for them to handle. You know, once again, I think, and I've said this before, is I would really love to see a different developer being given Pokemon. Give Game Freak a rest. Let them work on some other weird little side project that they want to work on for maybe a year or two or three. Give a Pokemon game to somebody else. Give them to once Retro finally finishes working on Metroid Prime 4, give it to Retro, give it to Monolith. Give it to any number of the developers that Nintendo works directly with. Give it to HAL Laboratory. It's just like Game Freak seems to have issues getting things to look good and then not just iterating on the same systems over and over and over again. The water textures are terrible. And like looking at something that like has water behind it visually, then produces this weird shimmering around it, even though like it's not like spatially directly in front of water. Like I don't understand what's going on there. And I say that as somebody that did like texture mapping as a final project in computer science in college for a graphics course. I don't understand what's going on there. It's just weird. The movement controls, it may just be the pro controller that I'm using. I do at some point need to pick up a new pro controller. I think I am having issues with drift on them, so I don't know if I'm just having issues with moving around. But it seems like there's a little bit of stickiness when moving. It doesn't feel as tight. There is weird, like little floaty issues happening when you fall. Like it feels like you float a little bit. So it's not if you're coming from Breath of the Wild, it does not feel as snappy. Like there's no climbing, there's no jumping. It feels like they, ultimately this feels like a somewhat, but not quite fully polished tech demo for what they could do with future Pokemon games. And I mean, that's fine. I just wish they would put a little more polish on it. Now that we've gotten that out of the room, I think a lot of like the gathering systems, they work. I wish, you essentially, like, when you want to gather resources, unless it's, like, an herb that you pick up out of the ground, for things like berries and apricorns, there's, stone and metal in the game, like, you have to throw your Pokemon at that resource, and then they just bop it, and it makes it fall out. That's an interesting little mechanic, but ultimately, you can use any Pokemon to do that. I would have wished that they, as a way to do HMs, had it require certain like types of Pokemon that you could have included as like a field move type thing. So like certain Pokemon like that you don't need to teach them cut, but they come with cut, or they come with strength, or they come with rock smash or something like that. And like you need a Pokemon with rock smash to, smash iron ore, or you need a Pokemon with cut in order to, chop stuff down in order to get apricorns, or Pokemon with headbutt, in order to headbutt trees and knock stuff down. I wish they would have done that. Because I think that would have brought an interest in, sort of like Monster Hunter Stories had, where you wanted to get a good mix of field moves. but there weren't so many field moves that you often felt that you had to rotate things out of your team. Like, you could still build a team that you wanted. But also, because you can go back to camp to switch Pokemon out, like, it's not very punishing, you know, if you would have to do that. There is a fast travel system. So you can just, like, warp back to camp after, you know, a couple hours of gameplay. I think the biggest thing is not necessarily agile style or strong style, because I think it's an interesting twist on the gameplay. But I think ultimately it just becomes a bit of a trap choice, because it's, you know, agile style doesn't seem to improve your speed that much. So, you know, it might help faster Pokemon if they need a little bit of an edge, but, like, you're also taking a damage hit. I think it's, you're better off just using the normal attack, or if you think you can go strong style and knock it out in one hit, you just go strong style. I think a much bigger deal is now the fact that instead of having to do the move shuffle with, you have four move slots, and when you learn something, you replace it. You replace one of your existing moves. Now it's, you have four move slots that you can equip moves to, but then you also have a move list. And when you learn moves, they just get added to your move list. And then you move. And then, like, they automatically fill up your move slots. But then on the fly, anytime from the field menu, you can switch moves and, you know, swap any moves that you know and have access to. So it's instead of being sorcerer, to put it in D&D terms, instead of Pokemon being sorcerers, as they have traditionally always been, they are now wizards. Sorry, I'm getting texts that I don't want to respond to right now. So I think that's huge for Pokemon. It's a staple, because, like, it was a thing that you could do in RPG Maker one RPG Maker generation ago, with plugins. And certainly in generations before that. But the fact that you no longer have to constantly learn and relearn things based on your situation, it feels a little more modern now. Because now it's, I think going forward is Game Freak can kind of tweak move lists a bit and say, what is a full kit that we want this Pokemon to have access to? And thinking about that, what are certain combinations where you could do a build for this Pokemon? Now, I say that I think that's giving Game Freak a little too much credit. I think it, for a developer like, say, Blizzard or Riot, who are used to thinking about things like MOBAs and MMOs, you know, that would be great. And say, like, oh, well, you could have three different builds for this character that you pull from, you know, this list of skills that they know, and be able to say, like, oh, well, this is a tank build, this is a, you know, like a bulky offensive build, or this is like a, you know, a support build sort of a thing, based on which moves that you pull from your move pool. I don't think Game Freak's going to do that, because I think they're probably still too hamstrung by tradition, and how Pokemon have worked in the past, but, here's hoping. So I like that. Having a quest system in place, I think work, you know, it's an open world game. I think that works. I think there are, So, at a certain point, you unlock the ability to get that you can buy evolution items. Okay. I think a great, it kind of goes against the original intent of Pokemon back from Red and Blue, but I think a great change. Is that now, there is an item in the game that lets you evolve Pokemon that normally have to be traded without trading them. You know, just in case, you know, let's say you play Pokemon and nobody else, you know, plays that version of Pokemon. And so now you have a whole list of Pokemon that you can't evolve. This solves that problem. And, you know, I think that's... But the ability to trade, excuse me, still exists within the game. So, like, if you still want to do that and trade with your friends, you can do that. But this way, like, it's an option for not having to go through the hassle of doing that. And I think that's great. I think that's... It's really good to provide players options for things. You know... The crafting is pretty good. It's fairly simple. I like it. You can do it from the field. I'm a sucker for crafting system and crafting mechanics. Have not encountered any fishing yet. So we'll have to see. I don't know. I don't think we're going to get fishing, folks. And this is kind of a big deal for me. Yeah. I mean, I think all in all... Again, I'm trying not to do story spoilers, so you know, I think some of the button assignments are they feel a little off, but they're doable. You know, they're workable. I think you have to like push the joystick in order to toggle running. Whereas like B is to crouch and hide. And I think I would have swapped those. And as there's no jump button, which seems weird for like an open world game, like with mountains and everything. So, they do give you like a dodge ability after maybe like an hour of gameplay. So often I'm finding myself using that as a jump, but it's not like it's like a horizontal jump as opposed to a vertical jump. Still, it would have been nice to have a vertical jump. So yeah, and then alpha Pokemon are a thing where they're just like essentially elite version of Pokemon that are out in the field. Provides a nice challenge for going out, you know, and catching a bigger, stronger Pokemon that might know specific moves. It's ultimately the battles in this game. I will say, so story-wise, the battles in this game are a little on the more difficult side. So I think that's where everybody that was hemming and hawing about not being able to turn EXP share off, because that's a standard in the game. I don't know if that's really an issue. It's also... If you want to level one Pokemon and not others, Pokemon get a, you know, whichever Pokemon you use to get gathering experience, gets experience. That is not shared. Whereas battling shares it among everybody. So you could just go around and like collect ore or collect berries or whatever with one Pokemon to level them up and do it that way. If you're worried. And I've done that, like, to help, like, get Pokemon that have fallen behind caught back up. Because I, you know, it's an open world game. I'm used to open world games and RPGs. I'll go around, I'll collect everything. So that ends up being a lot of experience. I think the capturing mechanics are nice. I do like that there are different types of Pokemon behaviors out in the field where it's friendly, fearful or aggressive. I'm worried that like as I get later in the game, it's just going to be more and more Pokemon are aggressive. Which my hope would be that like even more powerful Pokemon would still be fearful, right? And still just be like, oh no, I'm going to run away. Or if the game's difficulty is just making everything aggressive towards you. It's essentially putting in a little bit of an aggro system, but also, like, for some Pokemon, their aggro is to just like run up to and be like, oh, hi, welcome to the neighborhood. But there's different, you know, the different types of Pokeballs that you can craft all have different mechanics to them, which I think is neat and interesting, and not just like, not just affecting the catch rate, but like literally having, if different things happen or different throwing mechanics to them. So I think that's nice. It's a nice addition for me. I still haven't, you know, I haven't gotten super far into the game. So far, some of the boss battles have either been pretty standard, or there was one that did have alternate mechanics, but it just ultimately felt silly. You know, I can certainly talk about that on stream, because folks will have already seen it. It's like you can get through that boss battle without ever throwing your Pokemon out there, to do a Pokemon battle. So that's a little weird. And then just how that boss is presented is, it feels a bit silly. I think overall the story presents many questions, and it's a bit weird. But as I said, I don't want to spoil anything. Depending on certain assumptions, like if you make a certain assumption about your character, the game gets even sillier with how everyone else, like how all the other NPCs react to you and like treat you and the questions that they ask you. I think that's been long enough talking about that. As to whether or not to play it, you know, I mean, there's so many games that are coming out. I'm enjoying it when I play it. Don't get me wrong. But I think I need to put more time in before I can actually recommend it to people. Especially if you care about the visuals. I'm going to say, if you are a person that really cares about good looking visuals, I would say maybe pass and wait to see like the next game that Game Freak does that uses these systems. And hopefully they can make it look better. If you are a big Pokemon fan, you know, it might be worth checking out. I doubt it's ever going to go on sale. So, you know, unless you have like points at GameStop or something. Mechanics wise, definitely a step up from past Pokemon games. As far as I know, I don't know if there's Pokemon breeding. There may be certain systems that are missing. The Pokedex. I do like the fact that the Pokedex is just a notebook. I don't like the fact that it's called a Pokedex. And the fact that, like, they give you goals, and that's how you unlock more Pokemon data, is that, like, you actually do stuff with the Pokemon, and it's as you catch more Pokemon, more information is filled out. Or certain things are, like, certain Pokemon may need to use a certain attack, or may need to be defeated by a certain element type. And the more you do it, the more information you unlock. We're gonna be done talking about Pokemon Legends Arceus. Before we run too far over, just gonna talk about quest log really quick. All right, so I did get another Chapter 1 comic colored. So good on me for that. I did not play more Arcanium or Banjo-Kazooie. It has been chaos, pure chaos. And this week has not been a good week. Ultimately, I think Arcanum is just gonna be, if it happens, it happens, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. But I will try and get another chapter one comic colored so that we can get that done and then do some Banjo-Kazooie. And see if we can do that. So, that's going to be it, unfortunately. So only got one thing done, but we're going to cut out Arcanium. So we got two things to do for next week. That is going to wrap up this week's episode. Thank you all for joining me. If you want to see more content from 8-Bit Adventures, be sure to check out 8-BitAdventures.com. If you would like to help support 8-Bit Adventures, you can do so at patreon.com/8BitAdventures. Patrons get early access to comics, exclusive comics, behind-the-scenes content. You can become a patron for as little as $1 a month. That is 1/5 of the cost of a Twitch subscription. And I heard there was going to be other... I had a creator survey. There's going to be other stuff coming to Patreon too, that they're working on. So that's very exciting. Big shout out and thank you to all of the current patrons. Thank you for helping keep the lights on, keep the projects running. Your support means a lot. And also thank you to everybody that subscribes on Twitch as well. I don't want to, you know, leave folks who are subscribing on Twitch out of the mix here. But also as a reminder, if you have a Twitch or if you have an Amazon Prime account, you get one free Twitch Prime subscription a month. Please consider, even if you don't watch live, and you have a Twitch account, if you want to throw me that Twitch Prime subscription my way, you get some cool emotes for that. And finally, our opening theme is One Up by Professor Shy Guy. You can find his work over at professorshyguy.bandcamp.com. And with that, we are done. So as always, have fun, happy gaming, and enjoy your pie cake.